Welcome to the Locked Room. Stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mardell. And this week's story is The Ninescore Mystery by Baroness Orczy. Well, you know, some say she is the daughter of a duke. Others that she was born in the gutter, and that the handle has been soldered onto her name in order to give her style and influence. I could say a lot, of course, but my lips are sealed, as the poets say. All through her successful career at the Yard, she honored me with her friendship and confidence. But when she took me in partnership, as it were, she made me promise that I would never breathe a word of her private life. And this I swore on my Bible oath, wish I may die, and all the rest of it. Yes, we always called her my lady, from the moment that she was put at the head of our section, and the chief called her Lady Molly in our presence. We of the female department are dreadfully snubbed by the men, though don't tell me that women have not 10 times as much intuition as the blundering and sterner sex. My firm belief is that we shouldn't have so many undetected crimes if some of the so-called mysteries were put to the test of feminine investigation. Do you suppose for a moment, for instance, that the truth about that extraordinary case at Ninescore would ever have come to light if the men had had the handling of it? Would any man have taken so bold a risk as Lady Molly did when... But I am anticipating. Let me go back to that memorable morning when she came into my room in a wild state of agitation. The chief says I may go down to Ninescore if I like, Mary, she said in a voice all a-quiver with excitement. You? I ejaculated. What for? What for? What for? She repeated eagerly. Mary, don't you understand? It's the chance I've been waiting for. The chance of a lifetime. They're all so desperate about the case up at the Yard. The public is furious, and columns of sarcastic letters appear in the daily press. None of our men know what to do. They are at their wits' end. And so this morning I went to the chief. Yes? I queried eagerly, for she had suddenly ceased speaking. Well, never mind how I did it. I will tell you all about it on the way. For we have just got time to catch the 11 a.m. down to Canterbury. The chief says I may go, and that I may take whom I like with me. He suggested one of the men, but somehow I feel this is woman's work, and I'd rather have you, Mary, than anyone. We will go over the preliminaries of the case together in the train, as I don't suppose that you have got them at your fingers' ends yet. And you have only just got time to put a few things together and meet me at Charing Cross booking office in time for that 11 sharp. She was off before I could ask her any more questions, and anyhow I was too flabbergasted to say much. A murder case in the hands of the female department? Such a thing had been unheard of until now. But I was all excitement, too, and you may be sure I was at the station in good time. Fortunately, Lady Molly and I had a carriage to ourselves. It was a non-stop run to Canterbury, so we had plenty of time before us, and I was longing to know all about this case, you bet, since I was to have the honor of helping Lady Molly in it. The murder of Mary Nichols had actually been committed at Ash Court, a fine old mansion, which stands in the village of Ninescore. The court is surrounded by magnificently timbered grounds, the most fascinating portion of which is an island in the midst of a small pond, which is spanned by a tiny rustic bridge. The island is called the Wilderness, and is at the furthermost end of the grounds, out of sight and earshot of the mansion itself. It was in this charming spot, on the edge of the pond, that the body of a girl was found on the 5th of February last. I will spare you the horrible details of this gruesome discovery, Suffice it to say, for the present, that the unfortunate woman was lying on her face, with the lower portion of her body on the small, grass-covered embankment, and her head, arms, and shoulders sunk in the slime of the stagnant water just below. It was Timothy Coleman, one of the under-gardeners at Ash Court, who first made this appalling discovery. He had crossed the rustic bridge and traversed the little island in its entirety when he noticed something blue lying half in and half out of the water beyond. Timothy is a stolid, unemotional kind of yokel, and once having ascertained that the object was a woman's body in a blue dress with white facings, he quietly stooped and tried to lift it out of the mud. But here even his stolidity gave way at the terrible sight which was revealed before him. That the woman, whoever she might be, had been brutally murdered was obvious, her dress in front being stained with blood. But what was so awful that it even turned old Timothy sick with horror was that, owing to the head, arms, and shoulders having apparently been in the slime for some time, they were in an advanced state of decomposition. Well, whatever was necessary was immediately done, of course. Coleman went to get assistance from the lodge, and soon the police were on the scene and had removed the unfortunate victim's remains to the small local police station. Ninescore is a sleepy, out-of-the-way village, situated some 7 miles from Canterbury and 4 from Sandwich. Soon everyone in the place had heard that a terrible murder had been committed in the village, and all the details were already freely discussed at the Green Man. To begin with, everyone said that though the body itself might be practically unrecognizable, the bright blue serge dress with the white facings was unmistakable, as were the pearl and ruby ring and the red leather purse, found by Inspector Messier close to the murdered woman's hand. Within 2 hours of Timothy Coleman's gruesome find, the identity of the unfortunate victim was firmly established as that of Mary Nichols, who lived with her sister Susan at 2 Elm Cottages in Ninescore Lane, almost opposite Ash Court. It was also known that when the police called at that address, they found the place locked and apparently uninhabited. Mrs. Hooker, who lived at number 1 next door, explained to Inspector Messier that Susan and Mary Nichols had left home about a fortnight ago, and that she had not seen them since. "It'll be a fortnight tomorrow," she said. "I was just inside my own front door calling to the cat to come in, and it was past 7 o'clock, and as a dark night as ever you did see, you could hardly see your hand afore your eyes, and there was a nasty damp drizzle coming from everywhere. Susan and Mary come out of their cottage. I couldn't rightly see Susan, but I heard Mary's voice quite distinct. She says, 'We'll have to hurry,' says she. I'm thinking they might be going to do some shopping in the village. Calls out to them that I just heard the church clock strike 7, that being Thursday and early closing, they'd find all the shops shut at 9 score. But they took no notice and walked off towards the village, and that's the last I ever see to them two." Further questioning among the village folk brought forth many curious details. It seems that Mary Nichols was a very flighty young woman, about whom there had already been quite a good deal of scandal, whilst Susan, on the other hand, who was very sober and steady in her conduct, had chafed considerably under her younger sister's questionable reputation, and according to Mrs. Hooker, many were the bitter quarrels which occurred between the two girls. These quarrels, it seems, had been especially violent within the last year, whenever Mr. Lionel Lidsgate called at the cottage. He was a London gentleman, it appears, a young man about town, it afterwards transpired, but he frequently stayed at Canterbury, where he had some friends, and on those occasions he would come over to Ninescore in his smart dog-cart and take Mary out for drives. Mr. Lidgate is brother to Lord Edbrook, the multimillionaire, who was the recipient of birthday honors last year. His lordship resides at Edbrook Castle, but he and his brother Lionel had rented Ash Court once or twice, as both were keen golfers and Sandwich Links are very close by. Lord Edbrook, I may add, is a married man. Mr. Lionel Lidgett, on the other hand, is just engaged to Miss Marbury, daughter of one of the canons of Canterbury. No wonder, therefore, that Susan Nicholls strongly objected to her sister's name being still coupled with that of a young man far above her in station, who moreover was about to marry a young lady in his own rank of life. But Mary seemed not to care. She was a young woman who only liked fun and pleasure, and she shrugged her shoulders of public opinion. Even though there were ugly rumors about the parentage of a little baby girl whom she herself had placed under the care of Mrs. Williams, a widow who lived in a somewhat isolated cottage on the Canterbury Road. Mary had told Mrs. Williams that the father of the child, who was her own brother, had died very suddenly, leaving the little one on her and Susan's hands, and as they couldn't look after it properly, they wished Mrs. Williams to have charge of it. To this the latter readily agreed. The sum for the keep of the infant was decided upon, and thereafter Mary Nicholls had come every week to see the little girl, and always brought the money with her. Inspector Monsieur called on Mrs. Williams, and certainly the worthy widow had a very startling sequel to relate to the above story. "A fortnight tomorrow," explained Mrs. Williams to the inspector, "a little after 7 o'clock. Mary Nicholls come running into my cottage. It was an awful night, pitch dark and a nasty drizzle. Mary says to me she's in a great hurry. She's going up to London by a train from Canterbury and wants to say goodbye to the child. She seemed terribly excited and her clothes were very wet. I brings baby to her. She kisses it rather wild-like and says to me, 'You'll take great care of her, Mrs. Williams,' she says. 'I may be gone some time.' Then she puts baby down and gives me £2. The child's keep for 8 weeks." After which, it appears, Mary once more said goodbye and ran out of the cottage, Mrs. Williams going as far as the front door with her. The night was very dark, and she couldn't see if Mary was alone or not, until presently she heard her voice saying tearfully, "I had to kiss baby." Then the voice died out in the distance. On the way to Canterbury, Mrs. Williams said most emphatically, "So far, you see, Inspector Monsieur was able to fix the departure of the two sisters Nicholls from 90 on the night of January 23rd. Obviously, they left their cottage about 7, went to Mrs. Williams, where Susan remained outside, while Mary went in to say goodbye to the child. After that, all traces of them seem to have vanished. Whether they did go back to Canterbury and caught the last up train, at what station they alighted, or when poor Mary came back, could not at present be discovered. According to the medical officer, the unfortunate girl must have been dead 12 or 13 days at the very least, as though the stagnant water may have accelerated decomposition. The head could not have got into such an advanced state much under a fortnight. At Canterbury Station, neither the booking clerk nor the porters could throw any light upon the subject. Canterbury West is a busy station, and scores of passengers buy tickets and go through the barriers every day. It was impossible, therefore, to give any positive information about two young women who may or may not have traveled up by the last train on January 23rd, that is, a fortnight before. One thing only was certain. Whether Susan went to Canterbury and traveled by that up train or not alone with her sister, Mary had undoubtedly come back to 90 either the same night or the following day, since Timothy Coleman found her half decomposed remains in the grounds of Ash Court a fortnight later. Had she come back to meet her lover? Or what? And where was Susan now? From the first, therefore, you see, there was a great element of mystery about the whole case, and it was only natural that the local police should feel that unless something more definite came out at the inquest, they would like to have the assistance of some of the fellows at the yard. So, the preliminary notes were sent up to London, and some of them drifted into our hands. Lady Molly was deeply interested in it from the first, and my firm belief is that she simply worried the chief into allowing her to go down to 9 score and to see what she could do. At first, it was understood that Lady Molly should only go down to Canterbury after the inquest. If the local police still felt that they were in want of assistance from London. But nothing was farther from my lady's intentions than to wait until then. "I was not going to miss the first act of a romantic drama," she said to me just as our train steamed into Canterbury Station. "Pick up your bag, Mary. We're going to tramp it to 9 score. 2 lady artists on a sketching tour, remember? And we'll find lodging in the village, I dare say." We had some lunch in Canterbury, and then we started to walk the 6.5 miles to 9 score, carrying our bags. We put up at one of the cottages, where the legend "Apartments for Single Respectable Lady or Gentleman" had hospitably invited us to enter, and at 8 o'clock the next morning we found our way to the local police station, where the inquest was to take place. Such a funny little place, you know, just a cottage, converted for official use, and the small room packed to its utmost holding capacity. The entire able-bodied population of the neighborhood had, I verily believe, congregated in these 10 cubic yards of stuffy atmosphere. Inspector Messier, apprised by the chief of our arrival, had reserved 2 good places for us, well in sight of witnesses, coroner, and jury. The room was insupportably close, but I assure you that neither Lady Molly nor I thought much about our comfort then. We were terribly interested. From the outset, the case seemed, as it were, to wrap itself more and more in its mantle of impenetrable mystery. There was precious little in the way of clues, only that awful intuition, that dark unspoken suspicion with regard to one particular man's guilt, which one could feel hovering in the minds of those present. Neither the police nor Timothy Coleman had anything to add to what was already known. The ring and purse were produced, also the dress worn by the murdered woman. All were sworn to by several of the witnesses as having been the property of Mary Nichols. Timothy, on being closely questioned, said that in his opinion, the girl's body had been pushed into the mud as the head was absolutely embedded in it, and he didn't see how she could have fallen like that. Medical evidence was repeated. It was as uncertain, as vague as before. Owing to the state of the head and neck, it was impossible to ascertain by what means the death blow had been dealt. The doctor repeated his statement that the unfortunate girl must have been dead quite a fortnight. The body was discovered on February 5th. A fortnight before that would have been on or about January 23rd. The caretaker who lived at the lodge in Ash Court could also throw but little light on the mysterious event. Neither he nor any member of his family had seen or heard anything to arouse their suspicions. Against that, he explained that the wilderness where the murder was committed is situated some 200 yards from the lodge, with the mansion and flower garden lying between. Replying to a question put to him by a juryman, he said that the portion of the grounds is only divided off from 9 Score Lane by a low brick wall, which has a door in it, opening onto the lane almost opposite Elm Cottages. He added that the mansion had been empty for over a year, and that he succeeded the last man who died about 12 months ago. Mr. Lidgett had not been down for golf since witness had been in charge. It would be useless to recapitulate all that the various witnesses had already told the police, and were now prepared to swear to. The private life of the 2 sisters Nichols was gone into at full length, as much at length as was publicly known. But you know what village folk are. Except when there is a bit of scandal and gossip, they know precious little of one another's inner lives. The 2 girls appeared to be very comfortably off, Mary was always smartly dressed, and the baby girl whom she had placed in Mrs. Williams' charge had plenty of good and expensive clothes, whilst her keep, 5 shillings a week, was paid with unfailing regularity. What seemed certain, however, was that they did not get on well together, that Susan violently objected to Mary's association with Mr. Lydgate, and that recently she had spoken to the vicar, asking him to try to persuade her sister to go away from 9 Score altogether so as to break entirely with the past. The Reverend Octavius Ludlow, vicar of 9 Score, seems thereupon to have had a little talk with Mary on the subject, suggesting that she should accept a good situation in London. But, continued the reverend gentleman, I didn't make much impression on her. All she replied to me was that she certainly need never go into service, as she had a good income of her own and could obtain £5,000 or more quite easily at any time she chose. Did you mention Mr. Lydgate's name to her at all? Asked the coroner. Yes, I did, said the vicar after a slight hesitation. Well, what was her attitude then?
I am afraid she laughed, replied the Reverend Octavius primly, and said very picturesquely, if somewhat ungrammatically, that some folks didn't know what they was talking about.
All very indefinite, you see, nothing to get hold of, no motive suggested, beyond a very vague suspicion, perhaps, of blackmail, to account for a brutal crime. I must not, however, forget to tell you the 2 other facts which came to light in the course of this extraordinary inquest. Though at the time these facts seemed of wonderful moment for the elucidation of the mystery, they only helped ultimately to plunge the whole case into darkness still more impenetrable than before. I am alluding firstly to the deposition of James Franklin, a carter in the employ of one of the local farmers. This man stated that at about 6:30, on that same night, January 23rd, he was walking along 9 Score Lane, leading his horse and cart, as the night was indeed pitch dark. Just as he came somewhere near Elm Cottages, he heard a man's voice saying in a kind of hoarse whisper, "Open the door, can't you? It's dark as blazes." Then a pause, after which the same voice added, "Mary, where the dickens are you?" Whereupon a girl's voice replied, "All right, I'm coming." James Franklin heard nothing more after that, nor did he see anyone in the gloom. With the stolidity peculiar to the Kentish peasantry, he thought no more of this until the day when he heard that Mary Nichols had been murdered. Then he voluntarily came forward and told his story to the police. Now, when he was closely questioned, he was quite unable to say whether these voices proceeded from that side of the lane where stand Elm Cottages, or from the other side which is edged by the low brick wall. Finally, Inspector Messier, who really showed an extraordinary sense of what was dramatic, here produced a document which he had reserved for the last. This was a piece of paper which he had found in the red leather purse already mentioned, and which at first had not been thought very important, as the writing was identified by several people as that of the deceased, and consisted merely of a series of dates and hours scribbled in pencil on a scrap of notepaper. But suddenly, those dates had assumed a weird and terrible significance. 2 of them, at least, December 26th and January 1st, is followed by 10 a.m. These were days on which Mr. Lydgate came over to 9 Score and took Mary for drives. 1 or 2 witnesses swore to this positively. Both dates had been local meets of the harriers, to which other folk from the village had gone, and Mary had openly said afterwards how much she had enjoyed these. The other dates, there were 6 altogether, were more or less vague. 1 Mrs. Hooker remembered as being coincident with a day Mary Nichols had spent away from home, but the last date, scribbled in the same handwriting, was January 23rd, and below it the hour, 6 p.m. The coroner now adjourned the inquest. An explanation from Mr. Lionel Lydgate had become imperative.
Public excitement had by now reached a very high pitch. It was no longer a case of mere local interest. The country inns all round the immediate neighborhood were packed with visitors from London. Artists, journalists, dramatists, and actor-managers, whilst the hotels and fly proprietors of Canterbury were doing a roaring trade. Certain facts and one vivid picture stood out clearly before the thoughtful mind in the midst of a chaos of conflicting and irrelevant evidence. The picture was that of the two women tramping in the wet and pitch-dark night towards Canterbury. Beyond that, everything was a blur. When did Mary Nichols come back to Ninescore, and why? To keep an appointment made with Lionel Lydgate, it was openly whispered. But that appointment, if the rough notes were interpreted rightly, was for the very day on which she and her sister went away from home. A man's voice called to her at 6:30, certainly, and she replied to it. Franklin the carter heard her. But 30 minutes afterwards, Mrs. Hooker heard her voice when she left home with her sister, and she visited Mrs. Williams after that. The only theory compatible with all this was, of course, that Mary merely accompanied Susan part of the way to Canterbury, then went back to meet her lover, who enticed her into the deserted grounds of Ash Court, and there murdered her. The motive was not far to seek. Mr. Lionel Lydgate, about to marry, wished to silence forever a voice that threatened to be unpleasantly persistent in its demands for money and in its threats of scandal. But there was one great argument against that theory: the disappearance of Susan Nichols. She had been extensively advertised for. The murder of her sister was published broadcast in the United Kingdom. She could not be ignorant of it. And above all, she hated Mr. Lydgate. Why did she not come and add the weight of her testimony against him, if indeed he was guilty? And if Mr. Lydgate was innocent, then where was the criminal? And why had Susan Nichols disappeared? Why? 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 Well, the next day would show. Mr. Lionel Lydgate had been cited by the police to give evidence at the adjourned inquest. Good-looking, very athletic, and obviously frightfully upset and nervous, he entered the little courtroom, accompanied by his solicitor, just before the coroner and jury took their seats. He looked keenly at Lady Molly as he sat down, and from the expression of his face I guessed that he was much puzzled to know who she was. He was the first witness called. Manfully and clearly he gave a concise account of his association with the deceased. "She was pretty and amusing," he said. "I liked to take her out. When I was in the neighborhood, it was no trouble to me. There was no harm in her, whatever the village gossips might say. I know she had been in trouble, as they say, but that had nothing to do with me. It wasn't for me to be hard on a girl, and I fancy she has been very badly treated by some scoundrel." Here he was hard-pressed by the coroner, who wished him to explain what he meant. But Mr. Lydgate turned obstinate, and to every leading question he replied stolidly and very emphatically, "I don't know who it was. It had nothing to do with me. But I was sorry for the girl because of everyone turning against her, including her sister, and I tried to give her a little pleasure when I could." That was all right, very sympathetically told. The public quite liked this pleasing specimen of English cricket, golf, and football-loving manhood. Subsequently, Mr. Lydgate admitted meeting Mary on December 26th and January 1st, but he swore most emphatically that that was the last he ever saw of her. "But the 23rd of January," here insinuated the coroner, "you made an appointment with the deceased then?" "Certainly not," he replied. "But you met her on that day?" "Most emphatically, no," he replied quietly. "I went down to Edbrook Castle, my brother's place in Lincolnshire, on the 20th of last month and only got back to town about 3 days ago.
You swear to that, Mr. Lidgett? Asked the coroner.
I do indeed, and there are a score of witnesses to bear me out, the family, the house party, the servants.
He tried to dominate his own excitement, I suppose, poor man. He had only just realized that certain horrible suspicions had been resting upon him. His solicitor pacified him, and presently he sat down, whilst I must say that everyone there present was relieved at the thought that the handsome young athlete was not a murderer, after all. To look at him, it certainly seemed preposterous. But then, of course, there was the deadlock, and as there were no more witnesses to be heard, no new facts to elucidate, the jury returned the usual verdict against some person or persons unknown, and we, the keenly interested spectators, were left to face the problem. Who murdered Mary Nicholl? And where was her sister, Susan? After the verdict, we found our way back to our lodgings. Lady Molly tramped along silently with that deep furrow between her brows, which I knew meant that she was in deep thought.
Now, we'll have some tea, I said with a sigh of relief as soon as we entered the cottage door.
No, you won't, replied my lady dryly. I am going to write out a telegram, and we'll go straight on to Canterbury and send it from there.
To Canterbury? I gasped. 2 hours' walk at least, for I don't suppose we can get a trap, and it is 3:30. Why not send your telegram from 90?
Mary, you were stupid, was all the reply I got. She wrote out 2 telegrams, one of which was at least 36 words long, and once more calling to me to come along, we set out for Canterbury. I was tealess, cross, and puzzled. Lady Molly was alert, cheerful, and irritatingly active.
We reached the first telegraph office a little before 5. My lady sent the telegram without condescending to tell me anything of its destination or contents. Then she took me to the Castle Hotel and graciously offered me tea.
May I be allowed to inquire whether you propose tramping back to 90 tonight? I asked with a slight touch of sarcasm, as I really felt put out.
No, Mary, she replied, quietly munching a bit of Sally Lunn. I have engaged a couple of rooms at this hotel, and wired the chief that any message will find us here tomorrow morning. After that, there was nothing for it but quietude, patience, and finally, supper and bed. The next morning, my lady walked into my room before I had finished dressing. She had a newspaper in her hand and threw it down on the bed as she said calmly,
"It was in the evening paper, all right, last night. I think we shall be in time."
No use asking her what it meant. It was easier to pick up the paper, which I did. It was a late edition of one of the leading London evening shockers, and at once the front page with its startling headline attracted my attention.
The 90 mystery, Mary Nicholl's baby dying.
Then below that a short paragraph. We regret to learn that the little baby daughter of the unfortunate girl who was murdered recently at Ash Court, 90, Kent, under such terrible and mysterious circumstances, is very seriously ill at the cottage of Mrs. Williams, in whose charge she is. The local doctor who visited her today declares that she cannot last more than a few hours. At the time of going to press, the nature of the child's complaint was not known to our special representative at 90.
What does this mean? I gasped.
But before she could reply, there was a knock at the door.
Telegram for Miss Granard, said the voice of the hall porter.
Quick, Mary, said Lady Molly eagerly. I told the chief and also Monsieur to wire here and to you.
The telegram turned out to have come from 90 and was signed Monsieur. Lady Molly read it out aloud.
Mary Nicholls arrived here this morning. Detained her at station. Come at once.
Mary Nicholls? I don't understand, was all I could contrive to say,
but she only replied, "I knew it! I knew it! Oh, Mary, what a wonderful thing is human nature, and how I thank heaven that gave me a knowledge of it." She made me get dressed, all in a hurry, and then we swallowed some breakfast hastily whilst a fly was being got for us. I had perforce to satisfy my curiosity from my own inner consciousness. Lady Molly was too absorbed to take any notice of me. Evidently, the chief knew what she had done and approved of it. The telegram from Messieurs pointed to that. My lady had suddenly become a personality. Dressed very quietly and in a smart, close-fitting hat, she looked years older than her age, owing to the seriousness of her mien. The fly took us to Ninescore fairly quickly. At the little police station, we found Monsieur awaiting us. He had Elliot and Pegram from the yard with him. They had obviously got their orders, for all three of them were mighty deferential. "The woman is Mary Nichols, right enough," said Monsieur, as Lady Molly brushed quickly past him. "The woman who was supposed to have been murdered. It's that silly bogus paragraph about the infant that brought her out of her hiding place."
"I wonder how it got in," he added blandly. "The child is well enough."
"I wonder," said Lady Molly, whilst a smile, the first I had seen that morning, lit up her pretty face.
"I suppose the other sister will turn up too presently," rejoined Elliot. "Pretty lot of trouble we shall have now, if Mary Nichols is alive and kicking. Who was murdered at Ash Court, say I?"
"I wonder," said Lady Molly with the same charming smile. Then she went in to see Mary Nichols. The Reverend Octavius Ludlow was sitting beside the girl, who seemed in great distress, for she was crying bitterly. Lady Molly asked Elliot and the others to remain in the passage, whilst she herself went into the room, I following behind her. When the door was shut, she went up to Mary Nichols, and assuming a hard and severe manner, she said, "Well, you have at last made up your mind, have you, Nichols? I suppose you know that we have applied for a warrant for your arrest?" The woman gave a shriek, which was unmistakably one of fear.
"My arrest?" she gasped. "What for?"
"The murder of your sister Susan."
"'Twasn't me,"
she said quickly. "Then Susan is dead," retorted Lady Molly quietly. Mary saw that she had betrayed herself. She gave Lady Molly a look of agonized horror, then turned as white as a sheet, and would have fallen had not the Reverend Octavius Ludlow gently led her to a chair.
"It wasn't me,"
she repeated with a heartbroken sob.
"That will be for you to prove," said Lady Molly dryly. "The child cannot, of course, now remain with Mrs. Williams. She will be removed to the workhouse, and—"
"No, no, that she shan't," said the mother excitedly. "She shan't be, I tell you. The workhouse, indeed," she added in a paroxysm of hysterical tears. "And her father a lord?"
The reverend gentleman and I gasped in astonishment. But Lady Molly had worked up to this climax so ingeniously that it was obvious she had guessed it all along, and had merely led Mary Nichols on in order to get this admission from her. How well she had known human nature, in pitting the child against the sweetheart. Mary Nichols was ready enough to hide herself, depart from her child even for a while, in order to save the man she had once loved from the consequences of his crime. But when she heard that her child was dying, she no longer could bear to leave it among strangers, and when Lady Molly taunted her with the workhouse, she exclaimed in her maternal pride, "The workhouse and her father a lord?" Driven into a corner, she confessed the whole truth. Lord Edbrook, who was then Mr. Lydgate, was the father of her child. Knowing this, her sister Susan had, for over a year now, systematically blackmailed the unfortunate man, not altogether, it seems, without Mary's connivance. In January last, she got him to come down to Ninescore, under the distinct promise that Mary would meet him and hand over to him the letters she had received from him
as well as the ring he had given her, in exchange for the sum of £5,000. The meeting place was arranged, but at the last moment, Mary was afraid to go in the dark. Susan, nothing daunted but anxious about her own reputation, in case she should be seen talking to a man so late at night, put on Mary's dress, took the ring and the letters, also her sister's purse, and went to meet Lord Edbrook. What happened over that interview, no one will ever know. It ended with the murder of the blackmailer. I suppose the fact that Susan had, in a measure, begun by impersonating her sister, gave the murderer the first thought of confusing the identity of his victim, the horrible device of burying the body in the slimy mud. Anyway, he almost did succeed in hoodwinking the police, and would have done so entirely but for Lady Molly's strange intuition in the matter. After his crime, he ran instinctively to Mary's cottage. He had to make a clean breast of it to her, as without her help. He was a doomed man, so he persuaded her to go away from home and to leave no clue or trace of herself or her sister in Ninescore. With the help of money which he would give her, she could begin life anew somewhere else. And no doubt he deluded the unfortunate girl with promises that her child would be restored to her very soon. Thus he enticed Mary Nichols away, who would have been the great and all-important witness against him the moment his crime was discovered. A girl of Mary's type and class instinctively obeys the man she has once loved, the man who is the father of her child. She consented to disappear and to allow all the world to believe that she had been murdered by some unknown miscreant. Then the murderer quietly returned to his luxurious home at Edbrook Castle, unsuspected. No one had thought of mentioning his name in connection with that of Mary Nichols. In the days when he used to come down to Ash Court, he was Mr. Lydgate, and when he became a peer, sleepy, out of the way Ninescore ceased to think of him. Perhaps Mr. Lionel Lydgate knew all about his brother's association with the village girl. From his attitude at the inquest, I should say he did. But, of course, he would not betray his own brother unless forced to do so. Now, of course, the whole aspect of the case was changed. The veil of mystery had been torn asunder, owing to the insight, the marvelous intuition of a woman who, in my opinion, is the most wonderful psychologist of her time. You know the sequel. Our fellows at the yard, aided by the local police, took their lead from Lady Molly and began their investigations of Lord Edbrook's movements on or about the 23rd of January. Even their preliminary inquiries revealed the fact that his lordship had left Edbrook Castle on the 21st. He went up to town, saying to his wife and household that he was called away on business, and not even taking his valet with him, he put up at the Langham Hotel. But here police investigations came to an abrupt ending. Lord Edbrook evidently got wind of them. Anyway, the day after Lady Molly so cleverly enticed Mary Nichols out of her hiding place and surprised her into an admission of the truth, the unfortunate man threw himself in front of the express train at Grantham Railway Station and was instantly killed. Human justice cannot reach him now. But don't tell me that a man would have thought of that bogus paragraph, or of the taunt which stung the motherly pride of the village girl to the quick, and thus wrung from her an admission which no amount of male ingenuity would ever have obtained. Join me next week for another case of confounding clues on the locked room. Until then, beware of footsteps in the dark.